Hello and welcome to another episode of Podcast DX, the show that brings you interviews with people just like you whose lives were forever changed by a medical diagnosis. I'm Lita. Ron is off shooting today. Wishing him luck. He's going to be in a competition this morning.
And that is archery shooting. It sounds a little bit
weird. Oh, yeah, archery. That. He's shooting targets. Yes, shooting at targets. We don't hunt.
Sounds very weird.
Yes, we don't.
And I'm Jean Marie.
Yeah. Collectively, we're the hosts of Podcast DX. On today's show, we are thrilled to be speaking with Leslie Krongold. Is that correct pronunciation, Leslie?
Yes.
Thank you.
That was perfect.
Leslie is the host of a wonderful podcast herself. It's called Glass Half Full with Leslie Krongold. And we're talking to her today from sunny California. Leslie has a background in film and education, but she left her previous career field about 10 years ago after a diagnosis, which we're going to be discussing today. So,
hi, Leslie.
Hi, Jean Marie. Hi, Lita.
Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us today. Leslie, I understand that you've been diagnosed with myotonic dystrophy, a form of muscular dystrophy. We have listened to your first podcast episode, Glass Half Full with Leslie Krongold, which was wonderful, by the way.
Loved it.
But for our listeners, could
you
please tell us a little bit more about myotonic dystrophy?
Sure. It's myotonic dystrophy is one of many different neuromuscular diseases, but it actually happens to be the most common adult onset form.
Oh, okay.
It's genetic. Mm-hmm. It's genetic. So I was actually born with it, but I only became aware of it in my mid-30s. And it was originally named Steiner's disease. That was by the German scientist who discovered it in Würzburg, Germany.
Okay.
And the term myotonic, it became known as myotonic at some point because myotonia is one of the common symptoms, and that is refers to the difficulty relaxing muscles.
Oh, okay.
And usually it's the one of the first signs, or at least for me it was the first, was my hands. I had difficulty gripping and making a fist.
Okay.
Got it. And when did you first notice the symptoms of the myotonic dystrophy?
Well, I can really pinpoint exactly when I noticed it. I was working, and I went out to lunch with a colleague, and we were coming back. I was getting out of his car, and my hand wouldn't release from the car door handle, and it was, you know, kind of awkward, and I struggled a little, and, you know, I got the door open, but it reminded me of a symptom that my mother had talked about years before.
Oh. So. Okay. And what, oh, sorry.
And, well, I wanted you to go on, but were there any specific diagnostic tests that led to your diagnosis?
Yeah, sure. I mean, actually, so what happened was, you know, when I realized this happened, I became more aware that it was happening. And I went to my general practitioner, I described it to, and I didn't call my father, who was on the East Coast, mm-hmm. to find out what was the name of that condition Mom was diagnosed with, because I didn't really know anything about it.
Okay.
But the doctor thought it was a nutritional deficiency.
Sure.
And sent me for blood work. And then I came back and the blood work, you know, was fine. And she scheduled me for an appointment with a neurologist. And I had never, you know, there was no reason in my mid-30s to have ever seen a neurologist. I wasn't even quite sure what they did.
Okay.
But it was a diagnostic test with the neurologist called an EMG, which I believe is an abbreviation for electromyography.
Yep.
And that test you do, you know, in their office, there are thin needles that they insert, the neurologist inserts into different muscles, and you hear noises. It's muscle activity. So she was able to do sort of a preliminary diagnosis based on listening to that muscle activity.
Yeah, those are painful tests.
Yeah, they're not fun. They're not fun at all. And I understand that with myotonic dystrophy, the sound, they related to the sound of a dive bombing kind of sound is what they say.
Like
that the, yeah. Well, I don't know if it makes the,
oh, it just goes,
but yeah, that's and the kind of, it's a specific sound,
okay,
which is fascinating.
Who's listening to the sound when every time that they turn you up, the muscle tightens around that probe.
Yeah, it's not fun.
And it causes like a mini Charlie horse wherever that muscle is. Those are painful.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I actually don't remember being physically painful. I remember it was more like a psychic emotional pain because the neurologist, who was kind of young, mm-hmm. she probably was a little younger than me at the time, very smart, but she got excited, you know, because often they do. They get excited when they're able to
diagnose something,
provide a diagnosis.
Right. Sure.
And I was sitting on that, you know, whatever, that little bed in the office thinking, oh my God, my life is not going to be what I thought it would be.
Right, right. Did you say that your mother may have had this as well?
Well, yeah, she was diagnosed with it years before, and I'm in California. I was raised in Florida, and that's where my parents were. And at the time, they didn't maybe understand that it was genetic, or they didn't know because they had not isolated the biomarker for it.
Right.
They didn't have the blood test, the DNA test. But I believe science knew that it was passed on genetically. But my parents either didn't know or they withheld the information from me.
Okay.
So when I was diagnosed, she had died several years before from cancer, lung and brain cancer. So there wasn't a real correlation in my mind that whatever this unusual muscle condition she had led to her demise.
Right. Okay. And in a quirky twist of fate, Leslie, you actually know more about, or did know more about muscular dystrophy than the average person. Could you tell us a little bit about your time volunteering, raising funds, and supporting those with muscular dystrophy?
Yeah, sure. It's the big irony in my life. I grew up watching the Jerry Lewis telethon over Labor Day, just like a lot of Americans my age. Yeah. And I was in Miami, Florida, where, you know, there was a local TV show called Skipper Chuck. And he dressed up like a sailor, and, you know, there were other quirky characters on the show. And I watched this every day. You know, I can't remember what time it was on, but everybody my age watched it in Miami. And Skipper Chuck, started promoting fundraisers for MDA, Muscular Dystrophy Association. And I was intrigued by it. They were doing carnivals, and I sent away for the materials. And I was probably 7, 8, 9 years old. And yeah, and a few of my friends, we tried to organize it, but you know, we were kids.
Yeah.
We didn't have any parental intervention. It wasn't a success. But a few years later, the fundraising nationally focused on dance marathons. This is the late 70s.
Okay.
And when I was in high school, I organized 2 dance marathons at a local mall to raise money for the local MDA chapter.
Yes.
And I even had the opportunity, ironically, to present the check, you know, the checks to Skipper Chuck on the local Jerry Lewis telethon. So I ended up getting very involved with the organization. I would go to after school and stuff envelopes, you know, do administrative things. And I became a camp counselor at the annual summer camp. And I was voted youth represented, I don't know, Dade County Youth, and they flew me to Orlando for a statewide conference. It was a big part of my formative years. And then I went off to college, you know, and I wasn't involved in the organization anymore. And, you know, until I was diagnosed years later with a neuromuscular disease.
Right. Actually, yeah, dance marathons are back in fashion. They're especially popular in Seattle, where they're being used to raise funds.
That and sitting on top of roofs.
Okay, I don't know about sitting on top of roofs, but okay.
Police do it all the time now. They sit on top of Dunkin' Donut roof buildings to raise money.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I haven't heard of that.
And it also helps them lose weight because they can't reach the
door. Okay, all right.
Next. We got friends and relatives that are cops. Leslie, I understand.
Firefighters, too. Firefighters
sure.
do the boot.
And they do
sure,
the boot.
Right, yeah. right. Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Leslie, I understand that we did a little bit of research on it ourselves. With myotonic dystrophy, the voluntary muscles may be the first to be affected.
Like
and
you
voluntary would be like, you know, you're going to do a biceps curl.
Or when you grab a door
handle. Or you grab
handle,
a door handle
yeah.
or you're walking. Those mm-hmm. are all voluntary muscles. And there are involuntary muscles in the body as well. And involuntary muscles mean you don't have to tell them to do it. They're going to do it on their own. It's just part of the body's system, like your heart. You don't have to tell your heart to beat. It does it. Thank goodness. Yeah. So, are the body's involuntary muscles also affected?
Yeah, with myotonic dystrophy, it affects both the smooth and skeletal muscles. So for me, yes, a voluntary muscle like my, you know, the muscles in my hand and wrist were first affected, but it does affect the heart and the respiratory muscles like the diaphragm. Those are the more critical muscles involved that eventually, you know, lead to a more challenging life, affecting one's quality of life.
Sure.
And it's very varied how people are affected. I am still ambulatory, although at times I use a cane or a wheelchair for assistance. But I have friends that use, you know, wheelchairs or some other assistive device. And then in terms of the heart, I have friends younger than myself who have defibrillating pacemakers implanted, and then there are others that use some sort of nighttime ventilation to help them breathe while they're asleep. I have that situation now in the last year where I use different things to help my respiratory system. Mm-hmm. And some people do eventually have, you know, both, where the way most people with myotonic dystrophy type 1 die is either through heart failure or respiratory failure.
Okay.
So, and of course, those are both, you know, involuntary muscles.
Right.
Okay, right. And Leslie, I understand that, yeah, that, like you were saying, there's two forms of myotonic dystrophy, and those have very different onsets. Could you tell us a little bit more about that, and which form do you have?
Sure. And you know, like, it's only right now that we're saying there are two forms, mm-hmm. but it's very possible. I go to research conferences. There may be more than two forms as more and more research is discovered. And this has happened with many neuromuscular diseases like SMA, spinal muscle atrophy, CMT, Charcot-Marie tooth. The more science delves into it, they discover anomalies and more types are identified. But right now there's type 1 and type 2, and I have type 1.
Type 1
and type 2 have different genetic markers. You know, there are similarities in the symptoms, but they're actually located, you know, the origin of it is different.
Right.
And with DM1, it's usually called DM in the research literature. So with DM type 1, the severity varies. And each generation can be more severe. It's called anticipation. Mm-hmm. So I have classic adult onset. Had I had a child, there was a 50-50 chance of passing on the disease. That child would likely have had the congenital type, okay, which is much more severe. They're physically, they have a difficult time surviving. Now with medical technology, these children are living much longer and better lives, but they often have severe developmental and physical problems. There are special needs kids. Mm-hmm. And then there is somewhere in the middle, there's like a juvenile onset. And those children, some of them are nonverbal, but many of them you can meet and interact with, and they seem, quote unquote, healthy, mm-hmm, but they have a lot of developmental issues that preclude them from doing well in school, holding jobs, you know, having a quote unquote normal life.
Right. Okay.
And DM2 is often considered less severe. You don't have a congenital or childhood onset as far as research knows right now. But people with DM2 do have a lot of the same physical symptoms.
Okay. Okay. So adult onset could be DM1 or DM2?
Yes. But generally, I mean, there's a blood test that, you know, so if somebody exhibited some of the symptoms and they thought, oh my goodness, could I have myotonic dystrophy, there is a blood test that will, you know, absolutely prove whether it's DM1, DM2, or something else entirely. I mean,
okay,
because it would, yeah, be positive or negative.
Right, because they, yeah, can actually look at your DNA and the chromosomes and actually identify it. That's
okay.
I mean, it's great because
now that they can do that
because if you find out that you have it and that your child may have it, you can make accommodations to ensure that they have the best life possible. And yeah, like you said, as research continues, hopefully they can develop ways and different means of treatment as well. Are there any other conditions associated with myotonic dystrophy that we should be aware of, Leslie?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that question?
Sure. Are there other conditions associated with myotonic dystrophy that our listeners should be made aware of?
Well, you know, so conditions and symptoms, I'm not sure, you know, there research has proven some correlation between some types of cancer,
okay,
and having myotonic dystrophy 1,
okay,
and also diabetes. There's some correlation that with DM1 and DM2.
Okay.
But then there are a lot of symptoms. I guess you could call them conditions depending on how severe they are. Mm-hmm. There are gastrointestinal problems that are very common for both. I spoke of cardiovascular issues. Excessive daytime sleepiness is something that's very common.
Okay.
Insulin problems, benign skin tumors, dysphagia or swallowing, mm-hmm, difficulty. There are all kinds of eye issues like cataracts, droopy eyelids, which are called ptosis. Mm-hmm. It's a multi-systemic condition. Thankfully, nobody has all of these. You know, I don't have all of these. It's not a automatic that I will get all of these, mm-hmm, in my life. But they have seen enough of this that they are considered common.
Okay, okay. And then
enough of these symptoms. Yeah.
Sure. And then your healthcare team's aware of those and can just keep an eye out.
Right. And how is this condition treated? You know, like, are there medicines that you can take that can help?
Well, there's no confirmed treatment modality for either myotonic dystrophy type 1 or 2. There's a lot of research happening.
Okay.
there are pharmaceutical treatments for some of the symptoms. So very common is the excessive daytime sleepiness, and people are using drugs that were originally created for people with narcolepsy. And I know you just did an episode on narcolepsy. And then people who experience problems with myotonia, if it's very severe, there's a drug that people take that was created to treat heart rhythm abnormalities.
Okay.
But they found that it's helpful with controlling some of the myotonia.
Oh, okay.
It's fascinating. I mean, I believe this exists for other conditions where they look to other ailments to see drugs that were effective, and they find that they can also be effective in a different disease area.
Sure.
But I won't speak more about it because I really know very little about it.
That's okay.
In terms of treatment, for me personally, my respiratory issues are, more urgent than anything I've experienced in the last 20 years.
Okay.
And I am taking my first sort of pharmaceutical that I've ever taken, and I use a nebulizer mm-hmm. with albuterol in it.
Okay.
And that helps loosen mucus in the lungs, because a lot of people have difficulty coughing, normal coughing, which involves, your respiratory muscles. So I have a regime of using different devices and a ventilator at night that helps with all that. And then the other modalities I use, which I consider therapeutic, are things that I call my cell adjustments. And I've been doing this definitely for 20 years, probably before, much of it before I was ever diagnosed. And that includes a yoga practice and nutritional and dietary changes. I've made a concerted effort to have more control over my environment in terms of, helping my attitude, not being around toxic people situations.
Have you tried forest therapy?
That's interesting. I did a podcast recently and explored forest therapy. So nature is definitely important.
Yeah, we have a supporter for our podcast that has a degree she got her master's degree in forest therapy, and I'll turn you on to her. Maybe she can help you from, through over the airwaves.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful. I'm a big proponent of all things natural.
Sure.
Well, and I think that it also helps give you a sense of control, because these are all things that you can do that can have an amazing and profound effect on your own health. So that's absolutely wonderful.
And Leslie, what does the future of care for myotonic dystrophy and other muscular dystrophies look like? I know you say there's research, but I know you've got your finger to that pulse. How does it look?
I know that each year when I go to our annual patient advocacy conference, there are more and more researchers in attendance, and there's a greater interest from the pharmaceutical industry.
Mm.
So there are things that are in the pipeline, and we have a number of clinical centers around the country. I believe there are six now that provide very specialized care. They do research as well as clinical care for people with myotonic dystrophy. And the foundation, Myotonic Dystrophy Foundation, has just come out with the first consensus-based care recommendations for adults with myotonic dystrophy type 1.
Oh.
And this is a document that's available free on the website. And if you are registered with the foundation and have a family member who has DM1 or DM2, they'll send you this care, which really advises, it's a multi-systemic approach to make sure that you're getting the appropriate care and attention and diagnostics for the main areas, you know, respiratory, cardiovascular, nutritional, etc.
Oh, that's okay. Great. We'll put a link to that on our page.
Yeah, we will. And then as we've found out over the years, there are different hospitals and facilities that will specialize in different things, you know, like
right.
there
and
are
as
some
you said,
that are really good on cancer and there's some that are really good on gastrointestinal. What are the facilities that people would want to go to if they want the best of the best in this particular diagnosis?
Well, there are six of them, and I'm very fortunate to live not too far from Stanford University in Northern California, and all of these schools have a what is it called? They have a team, multidisciplinary team. So, you know, at the head is usually a neurologist because myotonic dystrophy is a brain condition, right. central nervous system. But they have pulmonologists and gastroenterologists, et cetera, all as part of the team. University of Rochester in New York, University of Florida in Gainesville, University of Kansas, Ohio State University, and a clinic at the NIH.
Oh, okay.
So they all, I have friends, you know, all over the country with this disease, and many of them, you know, are able, they're within 200 miles, you know, of one of these centers, which is really helpful.
That's excellent. We're really lucky to have that kind of resource here in the U.S., was there anything else that helped you to come to terms with your diagnosis or alleviated your symptoms besides what you spoke about earlier, which was yoga? And I want to touch on that yoga thing also. Do you find your muscles locking up during any of the yoga experiences, or is it just the opposite? Do you get more relaxed during the yoga?
Well, I mean, yoga, and I've been practicing it for a long time before I was ever diagnosed. And it's my practice has changed a lot. You know, it's not just about the poses. You know, it helps me emotionally. It helps me on days that I've practiced yoga. I usually have a better night's sleep. But I went through a research clinical study for 3 years, and the physical therapist I worked with really felt that because of my yoga practice, I've maintained a better range of motion for my, you know, my leg and arms. And I have friends, you know, who don't practice yoga and have, you know, the disease, and they have limited range of motion, especially, you know, raising your arms up high above your head. And this all affects, you know, quality of life.
Absolutely. You know, get you to breathe a little bit easier?
Yeah. No, I mean, so yoga has been, I would say, my primary modality of treatment. But there are many other things. I really cover it in my podcast. I talk about what's helped me, and I interview people about what has helped them with their physical and emotional challenges. But I would say, I mean, you know, for lack of a better word, a positive attitude, a focus on gratitude and being grateful for what you can still do has helped me, because I facilitated support groups for, it's been over 20 years now. There are a lot of people that don't focus on what they can do now. They focus on what they used to be able to do. And, you know, if you dwell on that, you're not going to be very happy and motivated if you're just thinking about, geez, when I was 20, I could dance all night long. Here I am 50 and I can't do that anymore because of my disease. Well, I don't know. We all age.
And there you go.
Even without a chronic illness, you know, you're going to have things that you can no longer do.
Right.
But by being able to, you know, be in the here and now, to borrow a 60s term, and not dwell on the past or be fearful of the future, I think that attitude has helped me dealing with the diagnosis and dealing with challenges. And I'm not always successful. I do have my moments of, you know, grieving or sadness or anger, but I try my best to focus on what I'm grateful for now.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, that's amazing.
A great outlook.
Yes, and a great role model.
Yes. Well, Leslie, thank you so much for joining us today. We've certainly learned a lot.
And Leslie, how can our listeners find your podcast and learn more about you and the community that you've created?
Oh, well, great. Well, my podcast and the blog are available at the website glasshalffull.online. And the podcast episodes are available on iTunes, Spotify, and other podcast portals. And we have a page and a group on Facebook. And we're also on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube.
Okay.
So basically, yeah, Glass Half Full Online. That's the term to search.
All right. Well, we'll definitely put a link on our website so that they can find you from there too.
And the podcast is definitely
we're going to be listening to yours
on a regular basis.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, thank you. I certainly appreciate the opportunity to speak with both of you.
Likewise. Thank you again, Leslie. And if any of our listeners have questions or comments related to today's show, they can contact us at podcastdx@yahoo.com, through our website, podcastdx.com, on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, or Instagram.
And if you have a moment to spare, please give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcast. And as always, please keep in mind that this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regime. And never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on this podcast.
Till next week.